And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, July the 17th, 2018. 14 coming up on 15 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. I am Scott Spears, along with you for the ride today. Now, we have got a great show for you this afternoon. Now, coming up in hour two, we're going to be joined by political scientist and author Dr. Ronald Fineman to talk about everything that went on yesterday and maybe everything that will go on today and tomorrow. Dr. Ron Fineman in hour number two today. Now, in the first hour, I'm really excited to have this person on because on this program we have had some people on who she has worked with, including Dick Van Dyke. Now, you probably remember her best as Samantha Konitsky on the 80s hit TV series Give Me a Break, starring Nell Carter, or as the voice of many of your favorite characters on countless television series. The guest today is Laura Jill Miller, but before we get to her, for all you nostalgia buffs out there, I know you'll know this tune. And our guest today, for the first time to these microphones, Laura Jill Miller. Laura Jill, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. When you hear that song, what do you think about?
Well, first, I was singing along. Second, I think, oh, is that the first song or the second song? But it was the second. And then third, I was thinking, do I even remember the first song? I can't even conjure it up at this moment, but I'm sure you can pull it out of your archive somewhere.
when I see that theme song, the only thing I remember big time is Nell Carter putting the vacuum cleaner in the fish tank.
Yes, and that was probably in the first theme song. Yes, she did, and they had people there to protect the fish, and the fish did get sucked up by the vacuum, and it went backstage into a bowl. So we didn't kill the fish.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Nell Carter, no longer with us. What was she like to work with?
She was amazing. I loved her dearly. She loved me dearly. She was really, really funny. She was an amazing actress and an amazing singer. I called her my mama. She really took me under her wing. When I first met her, actually, I had seen her in Ain't Misbehavin'. And I remember showing her pictures of me when I was on tour with the Music Man, with Dick Van Dyke. We had seen Ain't Misbehavin' for one of their, I think they did shows on Mondays so that other shows could see them or something like that. And I remember I had pictures of me backstage with a hat on and balloons in my bloomers and underneath my dress, and I was imitating Nell Carter. And then when I finally met her, I was like, I imitated you once. So I don't know if that's what endeared me to her or not, but she really did take me under her wing.
You know, when I look at that series of that time, boy, she was a powerful presence on camera.
Indeed. Indeed she was.
Yeah. And thank goodness for her, and thank goodness people haven't forgotten that series. It still holds up pretty well today.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's still playing, actually, some places. And I know that when I get letters on, you know, Facebook or Twitter or wherever, and old fans, and when I say old, I don't mean everybody's old, because that means I'm old too, but everybody still really likes the show.
They do. It's a tremendous series. When you started out in life, childhood, what was it like?
Well, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and we were just like a normal family, three girls, dog, cat, in the suburbs. And that sort of segues into, you know, how did I grow up in my childhood, which is I ended up in show business. So I was doing dinner theater work in Pennsylvania where I lived, and my whole family sort of got involved. And we did show after show after show at this theater in the round, dinner theater. And it was just great and amazing, and I did, oh boy, Sound of Music, Gypsy, Annie Get Your Gun. I played Oliver and Oliver, Fiddler on the Roof, The Music Man. And then it was at one cast party one time that some cast member, they were reading a magazine, like Backstage or Show Business at the time, and said, hey, they're having open auditions in New York for a Broadway show. You should go to New York and tell us what a real New York audition is like. So actually, I went, and it was for the show Evita at the time, which I didn't know anything about because it was new. And there were, you know, I don't know, 800 and some kids there, and we all had numbers on, and we got brought in groups of 10 to sing Happy Birthday, and then brought in groups of 5 to sing Happy Birthday. And then it was narrowed down after 4, 5, 6 hours. It was narrowed down to 5 of us, and I think they picked the 2 kids with the blondest hair, and they asked the rest of us if we would be willing to dye our hair blonde if we didn't outgrow it by the time that those other kids outgrew it. And that was sort of it. And then as I was leaving, and my mom was on the payphone, yes, it was that long ago when there were payphones, to my dad to tell him which bus we were coming home on, I heard familiar music in the door next door. And that music was from The Music Man. And I sort of stuck my head in, and I said, hey, what are you guys doing in here? And some very short man, who I'll tell you later who that was, said, we're auditioning for Music Man. And I said, oh, goody, can I audition for this one? I know this show. I didn't even know what that other show was. And he closed the door, and then he came back out, and he said, do you sing? And I said, uh-huh. He said, do you dance? And I said, uh-huh. And he said, do you play the piano? And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, do you have an agent? And I said, no. And he said, do you have a manager? And I said, no. And he said, give me your phone number. So I did. And that was that. And then I told my mom, and then I kind of got yelled at, because you're not supposed to give your phone number to strangers. And by the time we got home, there was a message on our answering machine to say, come in the next day to the same rehearsal studio to meet the. We couldn't understand it, because it was on one of those old-fashioned answering machines with, you know, a cassette tape where the ribbon got worn out. And anyway, we went back the next day, and it was Michael Kidd, who's a Tony Award-winning choreographer, and I met Dick Van Dyke. And I auditioned for him, and I read the scene from The Music Man, except that I didn't have to read it, because I just did The Music Man at home in Pennsylvania. I sang, I played the piano, I tap danced, I did everything, and the whole way home for 2 hours straight, I prayed and said, starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight, I wish I may, I wish I might get that show with Dick Van Dyke. and then I got it, and I ended up on a national tour with Dick Van Dyke, and actually Christian Slater was in it before he was Christian Slater. Dom DeLuise's wife was in it, so Dom DeLuise was on tour with us a lot. And then I was sort of a, I don't know, I don't want to say child commodity, but, you know, when you're little and you're really little for your age and you can sing and dance and do all that stuff. I ended up with an agent, got an audition for Give Me a Break, a series, and booked it and was flown to California, and that's it. So when you ask about my childhood was wrapped up in show business, so there was no easy answer to just go, you know.
No, it's interesting. Was there a conscious moment where you said, I want to be in that profession?
Well, actually, I looked back at some of my scrapbooks from when I was little, and apparently when I was in third or fourth grade, we wrote this book called All About Me, and, you know, you got assigned something every week, and, you know, what's your favorite animal, what's your favorite number, what would you want to be when you grow up? And my thing was, one day I think I'll be famous. I guess I'll probably go to college first, but, you know, because that was all I knew in my world, but I wrote something like that. So if those kind of things come true, then I'm telling all you, you know, second, third, and fourth graders, write down your dreams, because one day they'll come true. I don't even remember doing that, but besides that, I also found an old postcard from when I was flown out to California for the screen test for Give Me a Break, and I was also flown out for, I think it was a screen test for Little Darlings, the series, you know, Christy McNichol's role, and I wrote a postcard to my grandmother saying, wouldn't this be great if I became famous on a TV show? Even, and I wrote, like, all the pets' names, you know, Flower, Angel, Taffy, like, everybody's pets' names, like, even they would be happy for me. So I'm not so sure how much I had an exact realization. or that it just was continuing my biggest and favoritest hobby that I ever could do, and then ended up getting paid to do it. And I still say that now. I'm getting paid to do something that I love, and we should all be that happy. My dad always says, you know, a job is a J-O-B, but mine is an F-U-N. So I feel really, really lucky.
You know, it's interesting because obviously you stick your head in the door at the audition. That wasn't the show you were auditioning for.
No.
Just happened to be there. Most people don't know their defining moment. Do you ever think, boy, what if I hadn't stuck my head in there?
Yeah, that would be it. I mean, or the woman, Kathy, who gave my parents the ad to say, hey, go into New York, tell us all what a real New York audition is like. I mean, there's so many defining moments, you know, but that one, yeah, that one probably was it.
So, I mean, obviously you have to have the talent to back it up. You had to be able to sing, dance, know your stuff at that age. But what do you attribute? Is it luck? Is it God? Is it by chance?
Oh boy. I don't know. I guess I'll stick with covering it all. You know, fate, luck, talent, great parents, being at the right place at the right time, and something to back it up. You know, all of them, I guess.
You are now a young kid. You are touring the country with Dick Van Dyke in The Music Man. What's Dick Van Dyke like?
Oh, he was great, too. Very funny. Oh, when I first met him, I was like, that's the guy from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. As a kid, you know, I remember how big his feet were. I know that sounds weird, but he had these really long white sneakers. He was just kind and nice and talented, and we both got sick at the same time in Reno, Nevada, and we were in the same hospital. I remember that. We both had stomach flu. With a doctor named Dr. Pickering. I'll never forget that. And then I ended up with a monkey, a toy that I named Colonel Pickering for the rest of the tour. But he was very nice and very funny.
You're the young girl from Pennsylvania. Now you're touring the country with Dick Van Dyke. What is the experience like going around the country playing different theaters?
Oh, well, as a kid, mostly it was just the fun of traveling, and that was the year that, you know, roller skates were really in, so me and Christian Slater roller skated everywhere. Like, in Reno, Nevada, we would roller skate everywhere and then roller skate through the casinos and go to Circus Circus and get popcorn, and being in Los Angeles, we did all the touristy stuff and the beach and Venice Beach and San Francisco was cool. I mean, really, it was just all about the travel, the fun. It was amazing. I mean, it was a growing up experience for me, and it was a growing up experience for my mom, because, you know, my mom was just she actually was born in Ohio, but she met my dad in college and got married and had three kids, and she always says that, you know, that was her growing experience, too, going on tour.
Now you're in California, you're auditioning for something called Give Me a Break. When you went on the audition, did you know what the series was? What was the audition like?
Oh, actually, I auditioned for it originally in New York, and it was just an open call with a casting director who was named Randy Stone, and I thought he looked like Donny Osmond, and I told him so. It was just sort of a general meet and greet. And then I ended up with a callback where I had to read the scene, and then I ended up with a screen test in New York where I had one of my directors, actually, who directed me in Oliver in Pennsylvania, who was living in New York at the time, she sort of helped me. I had the screen test. I think I pronounced the word annihilate wrong, and I said annihilate. I'm going to annihilate him. And I always said that was, you know, maybe why I got it. No, I don't know. I actually looked back at my screen test many, many, many years later after the show ended, and Randy Stone, I guess, was cleaning out his stuff, and he sent a VHS tape to my parents and said, this is why she got the part. And I watched my audition, and I was like, yeah, I would have given me the part, too. I was good. But then they flew me to California, and then I had a screen test in California, and then that's when you sign a network deal, which means you already negotiate the contract, in essence, before you even get the part, so a few people have negotiated it. And when I was flown to California, I auditioned for Samantha and Julie. My contract said Samantha/Julie, so I was auditioning for both of the parts. So I had a pretty good chance of getting one, and little-known secret, although I've told this before, the first 2 days of rehearsal, I was playing Julie, and somebody else was playing Samantha. And then by the third day, I got switched, and I played Samantha, and then Lori came in and played Julie, and that's how it aired.
Why did they make the switch?
I think that the character of Julie, you know, I don't know about behind the scenes. I know that what I felt playing Julie, because in that, I think, first episode, she had to kiss a boy or talk about kissing a boy, and I just looked too young and sounded too young, and it just looked weird. And I think that they wanted me, and they just didn't know where to put me. Maybe they thought I was too old for Samantha, too young for Julie, and they were just trying it out. I don't know. I just know that that's where I landed, and I'm very happy.
Back in this day and time, there are three television networks. Very few shows make it on the air, very few pilots. When you were doing the pilot, was there a sense, this is good?
Oh, I didn't do the pilot.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
No.
And to my life now, pretty much every cartoon that I've ever done, I didn't do the pilot either. So that's sort of my track record. No, I didn't do the pilot. The oldest daughter did the pilot, and I think Bumper Yothers was in the pilot, and Tracy Gold was in the pilot.
Oh, how about that?
I think. I don't even remember. But I think Bumper Yothers, Tina's brother, played me. He was a boy. It was like a pilot presentation. Yeah, there was no... I wasn't in the pilot.
So the series had essentially really been sold on Nell Carter at that point.
Correct.
Yeah. So they made some changes before it went on the air.
Yeah.
So when you knew, now it's going to air, you're going to be on television, there's only three channels... I mean, even the worst-rated show is seen by millions of people back in those days. What was that like?
Well, I had no concept of millions. I just knew that we were on a hit show. I knew that literally, I think we aired on a Thursday, and by Friday I was recognized. You know, I was in the Marina Del Rey with my mom and a friend, and, you know, people were coming up and asking for my autograph in one day. So, and then when I was little, like the first season, every time it was Thursday night, and if we happened to be out during the time Give Me a Break was on, I was like, wait, all these people are missing the show. But I knew that it was a big deal because I couldn't go anywhere without having people ask for my autograph, or when I would go home on hiatus in Pennsylvania, my dad would, when we would go out for dinner, he would rate the dinners like, it was a 4-autograph evening, you know, it was a 7-autograph evening. Or I tried to go to, I don't know, one of these, what do you call it, like Great Adventure something or other, you know, where the roller coasters are out here. And I got mobbed, and I had to be escorted out. And so things like that happened. And unlike how it is now with social media and stuff, I can't even imagine now. But so back then, you know, people just had plain old regular cameras. And, you know, you were lucky if you got one picture that worked out after you took 24 or so. But I knew we were on a hit show. We were invited to all the, you know, NBC gala events. I went to the Emmys with Nell Carter. I was on Circus of the Stars and Star Games and Battle of the Network Stars and Star This, Star That, and parties and photo sessions and teen magazines that I never even knew existed before I was in them. My dad would have to, you know, go to 7-Eleven and buy a Star magazine or National Enquirer. And he's like, yeah, my daughter's in it again. Not for bad stuff, by the way. They were always set up things, but...
Yeah. It's interesting because that series, when it came on, it was Nell Carter's first series, the three girls' first series. Was it a fun set?
Yes. I don't know if it was for everybody, but it was definitely for me. I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I know my mom loved every minute of it. She knitted a lot of sweaters during all those years. I really got along with Nell Carter. She brought me to the Emmys. She bought me clothes. We went out for dinner and lunch all the time. We would go to Denny's across the street. Everyone would say, where do celebrities go for, you know, lunch or dinner in Hollywood? And I'm like, Denny's. We were on a set, not the set, but the recording, the studio was KTTV Metro Media Square. So it was us, Different Strokes, Facts of Life, Judge Wapner's show, Small Wonder, Rituals. There were a whole bunch of shows on our lot, and so we got to be friendly with a whole bunch of kids, too.
You know, that's interesting. The 80s were an interesting time for this, and the other two shows you mentioned there are kind of interesting dichotomies. All of the girls on Facts of Life, I think, went on and had careers and did okay. Different Strokes, a different story. The Give Me a Break girls... Joey Lawrence all seem to turn out okay.
Yeah, we're all okay. Yep. Let's pat ourselves on the back.
Yeah. Is it hard growing up in that atmosphere? Do you understand why the different Strokes kids went the way they went?
It's not... Okay. Whatever somebody would have done in real life, it happened in show business. It's just magnified. That's all there is to it. I had really great parents who didn't steal my money. I never got into drugs. There comes a time in everyone's life where they know what's right from wrong. They're instilled values from their parents. I was a nerd in school, so I was a nerd in Hollywood. You know, that's all there is to it. I just think, you know, I always said, oh, I knew where the drugs were. You know, that saying, just say no. I never had to say no. No one offered them to me. I knew darn well where to get them, and I had the money to do it, but I chose not to. I knew when people were in the bathroom doing something that I didn't want to partake in. I knew that when they said, hey, these are the cookies for the adults, these are the cookies for the children, I was like, okay. You know, I got good grades. School was important to me. School was important to my parents. I think it has to do with your family is really what it is. And it just so happens that maybe on different shows, you know, I don't know. If somebody was in junior high school, a regular high school, they always say, oh, it's so much pressure in Hollywood. I'm like, try going to junior high school. That's pressure, too.
When you look back at it, do you have a favorite episode of the series?
Give me a break. The one where Nell's father died and she brought me to back home and she sang and cried big crocodile tears and I cried and I loved that show. I love that episode, and I liked, of course, the one where I had an imaginary friend. Those were Samantha-centric ones. I had a great time. I can rewatch some of the episodes and go, oh, I know what happened that week, or, oh, I remember that outfit, or, oh, I remember who was in the audience that week. Like, it's so indelible in my mind because it was such a big deal for me.
As the series went on, one of the other stars of the series, Dolph Sweet, passed away. What was that like?
Yeah, we saw him getting sicker and sicker in, I can't remember which season, and they sort of, because I was a kid, kind of kept it a secret from me, but, you know, I could see it. And then he died while we were on hiatus, so what that was for me was just an odd feeling when I came back and he was gone. I wasn't around for any funeral or anything. It was just sort of this emptiness that it was just weird that he wasn't in the rehearsal hall every day and on the set. But as you said before, Nell was bigger than life, and she filled the space of my heart and everything. But it was just weird coming back to the set. I think that was probably the first time in my life that I'd known anyone who died, really.
The series is interesting for another reason. It's going along. It's a hit. And then one season, everybody in the cast is gone except Joey Lawrence and Matthew Lawrence and Nell Carter and Thelma Hopkins. What happened?
Your guess is as good as mine. I don't really know what happened behind the scenes, but I do know that I was brought back. That's what I know. I know that whatever decisions they made to do that, I know that at the end of the sixth season, I was brought back because Nell Carter wanted me back, and my character was brought back, and I was... And in fact, I was in like six or so episodes in that season. She kept bringing me back. I was always visiting because my character was in college in Warren, New Jersey. Littlefield College in Warren, New Jersey, named after Warren Littlefield of NBC. And then at the end, there was a two-parter show about me in college, and Nell was going to be like the house mom or something. And then the next season was going to carry on with Nell and me in the college. That's what I was told, and then we never got picked up. But I don't really know at all what happened behind the scenes. I just know that they sort of changed the format of the show, and then lo and behold, I came back, which I was very happy about.
When the show finally ended, as you say, kind of an indefinite ending, what was the atmosphere like?
Well, it was always sad for me, because I never wanted to leave Nell. And some seasons we were picked up, we already knew we were picked up. So when we left, we were like, bye, see you soon. And some we were just sitting there waiting. I don't think we knew it was canceled. I mean, at the end of the sixth season, it was like we were waiting to be picked up. So it was just normal sad, meaning I just didn't want to leave California.
Mm. Before we move away from this, because you do bring up Nell Carter a lot and working with her all those years, and she was a tremendous talent, but there are these not-so-happy stories about Nell Carter. Did you ever see any of that going on with her?
Not in person. I saw some ramifications and effects of, you know, not-so-happy things. But again, you know, she protected me and she loved me so dearly that I... no, I put it this way. I was never in the wrong place at the wrong time. Let's just say that.
When you look back at her not being here anymore, dying young, boy, I just think, you mentioned the NBC get-together. She was always singing at those. She,
I know.
Seemed like she could do anything.
I know. I just, I went to her funeral and I was just so, so sad. I was like, oh no, you don't know me as an adult. Wait, this isn't fair. She was gone. She's gone too soon.
And, you know, I think about today in the world of revivals, you know, and she would have been of the age to where she could have done one. And boy, what that would have been like.
Oh, I know, right?
Oh,
right?
Oh, the talent she had. Her voice is just something else.
Yeah.
Anybody who doesn't know Nell Carter, by the way, Google her, YouTube her, and just listen to something.
It's, well, she won a Tony for Ain't Misbehavin', and then she won an Emmy for Ain't Misbehavin' when it was on NBC. Yeah, she was amazing.
Do you think she ever got the credit she deserved?
I think so. I mean, well, that, an Emmy and a Tony. People just loved her. I mean, I don't know what else. They knew she was a talent, yes. Again, we were around during the not social media era. So, you know, you can only get the credit you deserved through, I don't know, newspapers, those old things.
When the series ended, where did you go?
Oh, back to Pennsylvania, and then I went to NYU for my undergrad. So I lived in New York City, and then I went to law school in New York City because I wanted to stay around my agent and still audition and stuff. And I did, like, summer theater and summer stock back and forth. I did Peter Pan. I did summer stock in North Carolina. So I stayed close to home. Pennsylvania and New York City, and then stayed there for, I don't know, 10 years-ish, and then one cold, snowy winter day, I came back to California.
What was it like to go back to Pennsylvania after this certainly national acclaim?
Well, I had gone back and forth on hiatuses, so, you know, home is still home, and home is still home now. Really, what was weird is going to NYU, because I had deferred for 2 years because I was still doing the show. And so I was 2 years older than everybody else and had a different feeling about college. I mean, for most people, when they went to college, it was their first time away from home, and they could drink and, you know, party. And I was like, ugh. So college was a little weird. I know that when I was on the tennis team, you know, if I lost a game, normal people would be like, hey, congratulations. And with me, it would be like, ah, I just beat Samantha from Give Me a Break, you know. So that was weird. Or my first week in school, there was on the cover of the NYU newspaper, there was like, who are you sitting next to? You know, is it a star? Or, and it was a little weird getting back into just plain old real world. People would stop me and go, you know, I know who you are. Or after I would make friends with someone, they'd say, you know, you're different than what I thought you were. And I was like, wait, why? And they said, well, when I first saw you, I said hi, but you didn't say hi back. And I was like, well, did I, first of all, did I hear you? And second of all, I didn't know you, so I don't know. But they, you know, I'm just a plain old regular person. I just happen to be on a TV show.
You know, that's interesting, because I think there is a misconception about people who have been on television that they... live in gigantic houses, and they're chauffeured here, and it's parties, and so on and so forth. What's a typical day like for you?
Oh, well, no, there's no chauffeurs. And back then, by the way, people did think that, so if you ever saw a limo, like, on the street, and I'd be walking with my friends, I would make jokes and go, oh, Dad, why are you bringing the car around? Like, I would totally make jokes like that. And also, the other difference is, you know, yes. Did I have money? Sure. Did I pay for college all by myself? Sure. Did I have to take out loans? No. That kind of stuff. Do I have money in my retirement and, you know, my dad bought me annuities when I was 12? future. So that does change things. But I also knew that it's like winning the lottery, and it could only be once, and you can't raise your standard of living up to what you're earning at any given moment. So when I'm out here now, and if I'm on a lot of shows, I don't all of a sudden go buy, you know, a Maserati and a big house, because all those shows could get canceled. So instead, when you earn a lot of money, this is, you know, money 101, you go, could this cover me for 4 years? Okay, I'll not raise up my cost of living, and I'll just know that I'm safe instead.
It's fascinating because I think when you are so young and on a television series and then you go into real life, I think about how you just talked about how people treated you at college. Were friendships, relationships, normal things that people go through at that age, were they made more difficult?
Well, you know, I don't have anything to compare to because I just had my life, but I have still my friends from when I was a child, like before I was famous. I have friends from when I was famous, but they were also kind of famous, so they get it. And then now I have friends as adults who are also sort of famous in their own right, because it's in the whole voiceover world. And do I have a different growing up experience than them? Sure. But everybody has a different growing up experience. You know, I've been having these sort of Saturday afternoon, you know, snack things with some friends, and they always like hear some of my stories growing up. But, you know, after a while, they get old. You know, they've heard them. They all have stories, too.
Now, obviously, anybody who's listening knows you have a very unique voice, which has paid off. Have you always had that voice?
Yep, except it was higher when I was younger.
When did you decide, or how did it happen you got into voiceovers?
Well, while I was in New York, you know, usually during hiatuses of Give Me a Break, and then, all, like I said, during college and law school when I was close to my agent, I did some commercial voiceover because back then, you know, if you weren't sort of the blonde Procter & Gamble button-nosed blue-eyed kid, you know, those were the ones who did the on-camera commercials, and then people like me did the voiceovers. And because I sounded 7 or 4 and had no New York accent, I just booked stuff. And, you know, I was a good actor. And then getting into animation voiceover was not anything I thought of. It wasn't even on my radar. Even when I came out to California in 2000, was not on my radar. I had like 4 cassette tapes in a shoebox of commercials that I had done. I came out here for pilot season. The very first thing I auditioned for on camera I booked, it was for Chicken Soup for the Soul, and then I was on The Amanda Show for a year. And I ended up meeting somebody in post-production at Fox. He was like, listen to you. Did you ever think of doing animation? And I was like, no. And then I ended up auditioning and booking a show and getting a voiceover agent. And I knew I hit it when there were all these people, you know, voiceover people that people knew and study and revere. And, you know, I knew nobody. And I booked Clifford's Puppy Days. And I booked Clifford. And I sort of felt like, this is it. I made my mark. People heard my voice and what I did, and they picked me, because that's what the producer had said, too. They were like, we just heard hundreds and hundreds of people, and the second we heard what you brought to the character, you know, we picked you. And I heard that for Juniper and Juniper Lee, and I've heard that a lot of times, so it made me just go, hey, I'm good at this.
It's interesting. One of the great friends of this show who's been on many times is Pat Carroll, who's the voice of Ursula in The Little Mermaid. And she had talked about how she approaches, because it's not her voice. I mean, it is her voice, but it's not. It changes a little bit when she does Ursula. Does your voice change depending on what you're doing?
Oh, yeah. My voice, my stance, my how much I have to drink tea. Yes. In fact, just talked to my dad yesterday, and he's like, hey, how come you had me watch that episode of Loud House? You know, I was waiting the whole time for Lisa Loud to pop up. You weren't in it. And I was like, Dad, I play Liam. And he's like, what? And I said, Dad, I'm Liam. You didn't recognize my voice? He's like, no, I was waiting for Lisa. I was like, but the whole 11-minute episode, you didn't recognize my voice. And he's like, no. And I said, oh, my God, I'm better than I think. My own father didn't even recognize me.
When you look at that, has there been a favorite voiceover you have done?
Oh, gosh, favorites. Well, like I said, Clifford's Puppy Days was sort of my first big foray, you know, hey, I'm the lead, I'm the title character. Clifford's Puppy Days was great because the whole time I sat next to Henry Winkler. He played the bird, Norville, so that was just amazing. I loved The Life and Times of Juniper Lee. I thought the writing was brilliant. I thought the cartoon was brilliant. Boy, if that show could come back now, it would really have a following. Oh, gosh, I loved everything. I'm sitting here looking at some of my little figurines and dolls and posters. Well, Doc McStuffins, Lammy. I mean, I'm just like, Doc McStuffins is changing the world one cuddle at a time. I mean, that one's huge. I love The Loud House Now. I love doing Henry Huggle Monster. My throat didn't, but I loved it. Wow, I'm looking around my room. I love Curious George. I love my character. Psy Girls. I play Izzy in Psy Girls, and we won an Emmy for that show. I got a Peabody for Doc McStuffins. That's pretty cool.
You know, it's fascinating. When you are on camera or your voice is on, do you like to listen? Do you like to watch?
Yes, I really do. I feel like I learn a lot from watching, and sometimes I get aggravated because sometimes I watch and I think, now why didn't they redirect us or do that in a pickup? Why am I yelling when the character's drawn right next to somebody? Or why am I talking like this when I should be flying in the sky? So, but I learn a lot, and it informs me so that I can watch other people, too, so that, you know, I've seen them in the booth, and then I see how it translates onto the screen. It's always a learning process with voiceover.
You know, a lot of people know who you are, as you have said. What is the biggest misconception people have?
Of me, personally?
Yeah.
I don't know, because I'm kind of an open book, so I don't think people have any misconceptions about me now. Maybe the one that you said before, which is I live in a palace or, you know, a mansion. I don't. Let's just get that straight. I don't.
You don't live in that palace. I understand. I'm with you. What do people not know about you? Say they know everything, but what would somebody who just sees you on television, hears your voice, what wouldn't they know?
Oh, well, see, that's the thing. I keep some things. That's funny. I just said, I'm an open book. But my friends know more about me than, you know, the public at large or fans. Let's just put it that way. I mean, even down to, you know, I'm not one of those vague bookers or people who post things. Like, during the time that, I don't know, I had my worst year ever and hip surgery or, you know, something like that, is like, wasn't anybody's business. You know, I still went to work, I still recorded, you know, I still posted a happy picture, and no one out in the real world actually knew what was going on except my family and my friends.
Where do you think that comes from, that privacy?
Being old. No, I don't know. because that's just not everybody's business. You know, I was totally famous in the 80s, and you could still have privacy. And nowadays, nobody can have privacy. But it's your choice. Also, autonomy. It's my choice. So you don't have to. You don't have to do this and have everybody know everything about you.
That's interesting. Because now it seems like people stay out there by telling everything about them.
I know, but that's not all. And we all know that most of it's not... Okay, not most of it. I take that back. Some of it, a lot of it, are lies. I mean, not lies. I'm not going to do that kind of news thing. I mean, like, you know, there's lots of things that happen behind closed doors or in people's own personal lives that they're like, hey, look at me, I'm all happy and famous, and I had a hair and makeup person, and, you know, and you don't know what I'm doing at home. So, and just to make this clear, nothing like that is happening with me. I'm just saying, you know, my personal life, you know, just things, I don't know, my cat died, you know, stuff like that. That's just, I just don't want the feedback of the public at large. I have great friends and great family, and they're my support system. And there's just some things that just aren't meh for public consumption.
How big a part of your life is the career now?
Oh, huge. I love my career. I kind of live for it. I am always saving my voice, you know, for jobs, for auditions. It's hard to travel because I don't want to miss auditions, even though, you know, we can travel with our inbox and our microphones and all that stuff. But I love my career. I'm milking everything out of it that I can while we can, and it really makes me happy. It really makes me happy. Like I said, it's not just a J-O-B. It's an F-U-N. Mm. And we should all be so lucky.
Absolutely. If you hadn't been an actor, is there anything else that interests you?
No. Well, I was a lawyer. Let's not forget that.
Yes.
I practiced for a few years.
Right.
You know, that was interesting. And I think had I had better mentors and stuff, but I could not get the show business bug out of me. I think I was born to do this. I think I kind of was. I was born, okay, here's private stuff. I was born 3 months early, so I was premature, and I weighed 1.5 pounds when I was born, and I was in an incubator, and my pediatrician wrote me a letter on my first birthday saying, you know, that I had great things in store for me, and that, you know, there was a reason that I was here, and maybe this is it.
Hmm. Is there anything you regret? A moment.
Okay, slightly. After Give Me a Break ended, maybe I wished I would have stayed in Los Angeles and not gone to college and law school, but going to college and law school and going back home and being home, you know, all that makes me who I am now. Maybe had I stayed in Los Angeles, maybe, I don't know, my career would have taken a different turn, but also maybe I would have died in an earthquake. So I don't know. So no, I can't say I have any regrets. I just can't, because I wouldn't be here, because I could have made a different choice, and then I wouldn't be here and doing fine and happy and all good things. So
we've talked about some of the people you've worked with, great, great people. Is there one that stands above all the rest?
Well, I would say Nell Carter made a really big impression of me. But are you talking about famous people, or?
Yeah, Dick Van Dyke, you know, the whole great group, guest stars that
I
were
mean,
on.
Yeah, I met so many famous people on Give Me a Break. Whitney Houston was on, Sammy Davis Jr., Milton Berle. You know, it's so weird. Everybody always said, you know, who's your favorite celebrity? And I'm like, I don't know. They don't feel like celebrities to me. They're just like us. They showed up at the set. I just never felt like, I never, you know, sort of bowed down to anybody. They just felt like, that's what they do. That's what I do. We both have call times. We're having fun on the set. We're talented. We, you know, learn our lines. We get directed by the director. I don't know. Maybe that's why I have a good head on my shoulders, because I never was like, ooh, I want to be like that famous person. The famous people are just like you and me.
You know, it's interesting, because talking to a lot of actors and actresses, something that seems to run through there, not with everybody, but I think there was even a book, Act One, written, that all actors in some way are shy people, because they're projecting somebody else. They're becoming somebody else when they're seen by lots of people. Did you ever feel that way, that you were shy, withdrawn?
No, but I'm also not like, you know, party animal, like being around lots of people or that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think there's those definitions of introvert and all that stuff. I mean, introvert doesn't necessarily mean you're shy. It just means maybe you're more comfortable with, you know, one-on-one or, no, not me, not shy. I was, you know, the little kid who went up to people's tables when we went out for dinner and was like, is that good? Can I have a taste? No, I was never shy.
If there's anything you could do professionally right now, if you could wave a wand and that would happen, what would it be?
This. I mean, this is the greatest career ever. But I don't have to wear makeup or get my hair done, and I can be acting and singing and performing and sharing, you know, what I do with the world and making people happy, hopefully making a difference somewhere, and this. I mean, I would love to just continue doing this.
Do you have a philosophy?
Oh, be good, be kind, work hard, love your family, don't take life for granted.
You know, Pennsylvania is right next to Ohio, And there could be a kid listening right now who thinks, I'm in Ohio, there's no way it could ever happen for me.
Well, Ohio is a little bit of a further schlep to New York City than Pennsylvania, because I was all the way on the east side of Pennsylvania. I would say there is never no way. Get involved in community theater, community dinner theater, theater. Really, that's it. I mean, that was my training ground, theater. And quite frankly, it's the training ground for a lot of people in voiceover. Everyone's like, oh, you have a funny voice. You should get into show business. It's like, that's not how it works. You have to be an actor first. You have to be a total actor. You have to bring the words off the page. So take classes. And I don't even mean voiceover classes. I mean acting classes, theater classes, musical theater. Oh, and another thing, singing. Most of the cartoons now all have songs. We all have to sing. We have to sight read. We have to learn harmonies. Be an actor, be a singer, be a comedian, study your craft, and then schlep to New York or California. And also, if you're a kid, stay in school, get good grades.
Without being too personal here, we talked about your career. Is there anything in your personal life, being as young as you still are, that you still want to do?
Oh, that I feel like I would like to travel more, but again, you asked me before how important is my career to me, and it's really important, so traveling sometimes is out of the picture. And I know a lot of people travel more because they go to all those cons and stuff, but I'm not doing those, so that would maybe probably be it, travel more. But I kind of like my life, so I'm not wishing for more. When you ask my philosophy, too, it's like, don't be happy in the moment, too.
100 years from now, when people look back, because reruns are reruns are reruns, how would you like people to remember you in your time?
Well, I presume, well, wow, I don't know if reruns and reruns and reruns will be reruns in 100 years from now. I'm figuring that some of these cartoons will be lasting that long, especially Doc McStuffins. Remembered as a good person. Who was talented and hopefully made a difference in this world.
I don't think that'll be hard to come by in your particular case. I have to say, this has been a lot of fun. I hope you have enjoyed it, because it's fun to talk to somebody who you used to watch and also admired their work and get to know the person. That's the fun part, I think, of doing a talk show.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. I hope you come back in the future.
Well, okay. I don't know if I'll be flying to Ohio, but sure. You know, if you wanted to set up another one of these, I don't know. I don't think I have any more stories. So I don't know. You have really good questions, so who knows? I could answer a whole bunch of other things that you throw me off guard.
we could go on and on forever and ever. Laura Jo Miller, thank you so much for being on the show today. Stay well.
Okay, thank you, too, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Bye. That was a lot of fun. We're going to take a break. Come back with Ron Feynman, Dr. Ronald, right after this.
East Center Street in the lower level of the Belltone Building. Thank you so much for playing fair.
Tecumseh, captivating, mesmerizing.